This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've all heard a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric recently, everything from banning all Muslims from the U.S. to pressing the pause button on allowing Syrian refugees. This week in Michigan, a daughter has been telling her father's story, and it's a lesson from history. During World War II, Fred Korematsu refused to comply with the order to put Japanese-American citizens in internment camps. About 120,000 citizens went into those camps. Korematsu has become a symbol of resistance to what is now seen as a shameful time in America. Karen Korematsu wants Michigan to be among the states to officially commemorate January 30th as Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution. She joins us now, and I have to tell you, I saw the story of your father on what I think was the History Channel not too long ago, and I think most of us are aware that during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt approved rounding up Japanese-American citizens and then confining them. Your father was having none of that. So what did he do?
Well, my father considered himself first an American citizen, and he couldn't believe that American citizens would be ordered to be imprisoned without any due process of law. And so clearly he thought it was wrong. He just wanted to live his life as an American citizen. He just wanted to get on with his life. He had done nothing wrong. So why should he be incarcerated just because he looked like the enemy?
Now, he eventually was arrested and convicted, although the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, it only had been about a month since the Japanese Americans were sent to first detention assembly centers, were basically horse stalls. They were just in the San Francisco Bay Area and just whitewashed the horse stalls. There was dirt on the floor, gaps in the walls, and a light bulb, and it still smelled of manure. So it was an awful place to have to live for about 4 or 5 months, sometimes longer. And so my father was spotted in a small town called San Leandro in the San Francisco Bay Area and was arrested. And so actually it was the executive director of the Northern California affiliate of ACLU, Mr. Besick, that was looking for a test case where he could take this all the way to the Supreme Court if need be, because he thought it was unconstitutional, you know, since everyone's due process had been violated. And that's what happened. But it took several years for the process, you know, with appeals. And so by the time it was heard, it was December 18th, 1944. But my father truly believed that by the time that his case would get to the Supreme Court, certainly they would see that it was unconstitutional. So he was so disheartened, and a word that he used was disgusted, because it was a 6-3 decision. But right, it wasn't unanimous, and that's the important point. In fact, Justice Murphy of Michigan was one of the dissenting opinions.
Now, your father went on to later challenge the conviction and that ruling in the 1980s. What happened then?
Little did I know growing up that my father had never given up hope that someday he could reopen his Supreme Court case, because he clearly felt that the government was wrong and he was right in what he had done. But he had, you know, he always had a federal prison record, so that was always went against him in employment and even discrimination in housing. But Professor Peter Irons was doing research in Washington, D.C. to write a book about the World War II Supreme Court cases. And he was looking through some files and found actually in the Immigration and Alien Department a box that hadn't been opened in 40 years. And right on the top of this box that was dusty was this file. And it was about the Department of Justice that proved there was no military necessity for the Japanese Americans to be forced removed from their homes. That at the time of my father's Supreme Court case, the Department of Justice had withheld evidence, had destroyed evidence, and had altered evidence. And so on that basis, they were able to reopen my father's Supreme Court case.
I want to ask you, how many states so far have agreed to commemorate January 30th as Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties?
California was the first. Governor Schwarzenegger signed that legislative bill in 2010, commencing with January 30th, 2011. And the state of Hawaii. And then just in February of last year, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the state of Virginia, also signed their legislative bill. We have some celebrations coming up at the end of the week and then also February 2nd to establish Fred Korematsu Day in perpetuity. We have Georgia, who has submitted resolutions honoring the day, as well as Pennsylvania. Florida has their legislative bill through the Senate and is now in the House. South Carolina, where my mother was born, has also submitted their bill. And we've had governors from Utah, governors of Illinois, even Hawaii before the bill became signed, that have commemorated the day by resolution and proclamation.
How receptive were the Michigan legislators?
They were very receptive. I had the most unbelievable day in Michigan's legislature. You couldn't write this. The story here, the connection to Michigan that really resonates, I think, with everyone is towards the end of World War II, community leaders went into these different internment camps and helped people find jobs so they could go east before the end of the war and not west. My father's youngest brother was already here in Detroit. It seemed that Michigan was very welcoming to the people that had been incarcerated, the Japanese Americans that had been incarcerated. So my uncle came here, and then my father was actually going on to New York, but he stopped here in Michigan. And my mother, as I mentioned, was born in South Carolina. She received a scholarship to Wayne State University and received her master's in microbiology, did research on penicillin at Ford Hospital, and then taught nurses Mercy Hospital and Mercy College and Mount Carmel as well. When they did decide to get married in 1946, they couldn't go back to South Carolina to be married because of the anti-racial marriage laws, and California hadn't changed their laws either. But it was Michigan that was so welcoming and so, you know, they weren't discriminating. It was truly unbelievable, because I asked my parents, I said, well, how were you treated? Because this is clearly back in 46, that's a mixed marriage, right? A Japanese American man and a Caucasian woman. And they said, well, they didn't really face the discrimination here. When my parents went back to California in 49, because my father's mother wasn't well, my father faced housing discrimination, employment discrimination. So it's truly a heartwarming story that I like to share. And it really seemed to resonate with the legislators that I met yesterday, because I think it just says a lot about the state.
Karen Korematsu visited with legislators this week in Lansing in an effort to persuade Michigan to officially commemorate Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution each year on January 30th. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
By the way, in 1998, President Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Medal of Freedom. That's the highest civilian honor. And Mr. Korematsu died in 2005. I'd like to add one more thing. Japanese Americans were not the only people held in internment camps during World War II. While the U.S. turned away Jewish refugees from Germany before and during the war, toward the end of the war, close to 1,000 refugees, mostly Jewish, were put in an internment camp in upstate New York.